drafting it, get a specific answer on when have a survey made for a very practical reason. The gentleman with whom I was to consult, I did not consult with until shortly before the bill deadline, and he was out of town. So we would get
the answer at this point, yes.
Mr. Chairman, did you ask about the patent? That's on the bottom of the first page where it says they shall be issued a patent.
Since you're meant to be qualifications for an applicant, generally,
that's the way I agree with it.
Yes.
And I agree with Mr. Park.
It seems that what we ought to do on this land survey thing, it would be now the way it is now, you're saying this kind of the regulation when the guy's going to pay for the land survey or when the survey is going to be done. But you know, it just doesn't make sense when you read the very first part of the bill on the classification of land. It says the director may classify for homesite entry, and he's got to classify this whole thing. So it just seems that obviously less is time when there's going to be a survey, because he's not just going to classify a big chunk of land and say.
They did that for the old major homesite stuff.
And then you just go out and stake it.
That's right. They allow you to stake it, and later, before you can purchase it, you have to do your own survey. You contract with a private individual and have a certified survey done. You got to stake it and give them a reference to where it is.
So then it's kind of up to the individuals to divide up on it.
That's the way they did it last time.
That's where they ran into all the trouble.
Yeah. But it seems like the state ought to do it just like they're doing now. They ought to divide up the land so there's some rhyme and reason to how it's divided up.
That's where the expense comes in, because I think it costs more. I don't know. You said $100 for a 2-acre homestead. Well, the cheapest estimate I got, the survey 5 acres, was $600, all the way to $1,500 for one, depending on where it is, of course. If it's out in the boondocks, you got to fly the guy in this whole
world. Because otherwise, I can see one of the big problems, at least we never had any land entry land that I know down here, but if we have anything under this, throw a bunch of land on a lake or a beach, obviously I'll just pick a nice long strip along the beach. You know, get my 2 acres there.
Well, on the other program, they limited it to 400 foot of water. Mm-hmm.
I would think the surveying cost should be cheaper for surveying the whole stretch of land than to make pretty a quite home site.
Right. Yeah.
And if you each person goes on those kind of visual, it should be a lot cheaper to do that.
Yeah, great
deal. Okay, nice. Well, did anybody from Natural Resources indicate there was any problem on the requiring the survey by the state at the time when the land was classified?
When I first started talking to the Division of Land, Mr. Chairman, and it was my intention and my idea that, again, going back to what I said before, that we wouldn't make that much difference in the procedure of disposal until we start, you know, how do you pay for it. I envisioned that the division would go out and there'd be enough outcry from certain districts, you know, we need some land, we need some land, they'll go, let's get them off our back. They'd go out and survey a bunch of lots and, you know, and lay them out. And I'm afraid, you know, this is one reason why I couldn't understand, and maybe because people read things in the bill that I didn't see, any objection that there would be hodgepodge, helter-skelter, settling on land. I never envisioned it that way myself. As long as the division goes out and surveys these things, makes them available, you know, and advertises in the paper, and people go for their permits and give it a try, it seems to me like this could be orderly enough, and there would be no reason for them to, you know, just people going hither, thither, and yon as they wished. And that's the way I envisioned it. I could understand why they felt there'd be so much confusion.
Just one more question. Would you see any problem in requiring the person who's going to get the land, at the time that he receives the permit to move on to the land, paying the survey fee at that time? You know, as I understand, he applies, and then they find out he's eligible and that there's land available. And then on page 3, line 11, he gets this irrevocable permit. And that's more or less kind of the temporary title of the land.
I'll
require him to pay the cost to stay at that
age. Yes, sir. I did think about that. I'll tell you why. Because this guy is living on a kind of a conditional use permit until the day he gets his patent. And under the terms of this bill, you know, if he gets a permit, let's just give an example. He gets a permit, he goes on there and he builds half of a house, and he decides he's not interested anymore, wants to go back to Oshkosh. When he leaves, that reverts to the state. And, you know, if he leaves a half of a, you know, a half-built house on there, under the terms of this bill, that belongs, that reverts back to the state. So I didn't, you know, I was willing to wait until the day the guy actually, you know, this condition of getting his patent, but he was qualified and ready to get his patent, and say, okay, Buster, you're going to get your patent, but you pay for your survey now. That's what I was really up to. I didn't, I was trying to hold it down so that people could start with very little money and, you know, and make their way along. And under the terms of this bill, a guy could, you know, within that would have to be something by regulation. But you know that end of the year, 2 years, the guy may not have a habitable dwelling built on it yet. And I'm like the rest of you, probably certain situations I kind of envision or picture in my mind a typical constituent. And I always think of some young guy, a wife and a kid, and he works down the green sheet down the sawmill, not making a lot of money, and he's paying pretty high rent where he's living. He never get ahead. He just can't get enough money to buy a house. But as a matter of fact, that's more or less the way I did. I started and with a small end, and I just kept buying boards and building buying boards. I could never had a good fishing season. I bought more boards. If I didn't, I didn't buy that many boards. But, you know, eventually I had a house. And this is some way, once you could start, you know, you might be living in a building. You might even have a building that he could live in, it still wouldn't qualify under the regulations as a habitable dwelling. But once he could move in there and get this load of the rent off his back, then he'd have a few more bucks to buy a few more boards. That's more or less what I was trying to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, there really is nothing new about this. The Forest Service has been doing it for years. The BLM used to, in fact, I have my quarrel, I have BLM fire in track one some time, which I proved up on that. But the Forest Service, if any, those of you who are in the Anchorage area, familiar with Kenai Lake and the Cooper Landing area, and hopefully in one place. These areas have had Forest Service home sites in the years past that became available to purchase. You went on the land, you had a, you know, conditional use permit until after you met certain requirements, which were building a habitable house. Requirements were minimal, but they were pretty firm in that you couldn't build a tar paper shack. In other words, they required a certain amount of neatness and order or certain quality of, not hard to comply with, but still, so when you did go off, if you went off and left it, what was there would be suitable for somebody else to take up, and it didn't degrade in any way. And hey, you know, people, at least in parts of the area, so the Kenai Peninsula, say, we wish we had the same condition imposed on areas where it isn't imposed, because it kept a fairly neat-looking degree of building, so it's not new. By regulation, those sort of things could be done.
Your pit three.
First line after the word super second year, we put in, but you have to be in the survey. But I don't know if we require, I think we're covered in some way.
Well, the idea is to free up land to persons who might have a hard time getting land in the first place to
provide them with Alaskan experience of getting it dead by a number of people dead years ago. I think it would only be,
I think it might be overly restrictive to ask them to come up with $1,500 survey prior to the granting of conditional title. Because obviously it is conditional title until they get resources that serve it.
I'd rather see them have to take the survey after they've met the other requirements before getting by.
Mr. Chairman, I would prefer, and I'll do this if you want it, on page 1 and 1.4. I would like that line better to read, the director shall classify and service the law. I put the fee right on the page of land to the surveying division.
What you're saying then is you want that would mean that all vacant, unappropriately reserved land that's suitable for residential development will be classified.
No, I didn't say all, but on the next page. And it says they should do it on a reasonable, rotating regional basis and rate consistent with the planning process, all the division, et cetera. So so it doesn't put it, they have to do it all.
That's something else I was going to bring up about the rotating regional basis. I mean, look at that map right there and you see that the blue area is what the state can give away. So guess which region should be the where's it going to rotate from? From Matsu to Fairbanks to Matsu.
Well, Mr. Chairman, right now you're taking nowhere. They have done nothing.
Right.
Back to that amendment. My amendment would have been the director shall classify state land suitable for homesteading. He would want to put classify and survey.
Yeah, I'm thinking of surveying first. If they do it in large blocks first, get it surveyed, and it's like they're going, just like you're going to auction it off. And they would put it up for bid, and your bids don't go on dollars, your bids go on what time then the state is.
Who's
going to pay for the survey?
Until they get the money back from the guy who had homes.
What? They're only getting $10.
The thing is, it's the way they do the land now. The time it's auctioned off, they get it back.
It's a lot more sensible to do, say, a 30-acre block, a 50-acre block, survey it and break it down into 2-acre home sites all at one time. And just try to go out and do one at a time.
The problem with that, though, I see it would be that the state would take quite some time to do this. They may be able to do 30 or 40 of these a year. I've been down there trying to get them to prepare survey instructions, which is what's required on these home sites. Like I had my home site survey this year, and it took them 6 months to prepare my survey instructions. They haven't got the people down there to do it. If you're going to tell them they got to go out and survey each one of these lots before they can make them available, it's never going to get done. At least it's going to be a whole lot slower if they have to do it. But you say that the person who's going out and getting the land, the burden's on him to have it surveyed. Well, at least it's going to get done as quick as he wants to pay for it.
You know how they do it? They do it by contract. Like when they held at least one auction, I don't know, they simply contracted, the local contractor went out and surveyed. Then, after he got all these markers, then the state auctioned it off.
Well, I don't see the real need to have a survey before you get it, I guess.
Because you don't know what you're getting. In other words, the guy doesn't know where to build or anything else until he knows. In other words, it fixes him on his own location.
So you're not going to have the state doing the surveys, you're going to have them doing the platting and the planning and everything else, right?
Well, when you say that the state's going to make it available, they've got to go out and do some kind of a survey to make a place available. You see what I mean? They've got to fix the location. Otherwise, you get back to all the problems you had with Open Entry, which was unacceptable, you know.
They're going to have to anyway. If you look at the very last thing on the bottom page, they've got to work this out together with the local planning authority. Now, they start to put these 2 acres to the side of 2 acres to the side. They come out in the borough out of it. They're going to put these out as land. But the borough has it classified as general agriculture, which is the smallest lot in the area can be, I think it's about 5 acres, 4.8, something like that. Then they can't be done. So they're going to have to some extent, do this kind of thing. They're going to have to some extent, not flat it, exactly, stake it out. They're going to coordinate the whole thing with local people.
Sam, your concern is they just won't do it because they'll say we don't have any money.
Well, even now, they've got the vacant positions down there, they're not filling. You know, there's slots for 4 of these cadastral engineers, I guess is the result. And they said, we can't get any civil engineers to have to work for us. So therefore, there's one guy sitting here doing these survey instructions, and that, you know, the waiting list is probably about a year now before you can get it done.
And they really nitpick. I've had a couple of these kind of cases where constituents have these open entry and they're waiting for survey. God, the guy sends it back and he lists all the conditions that were wrong, that the contract surveyor did wrong, and they're... Hey, they're just bureaucratic things that drive you wild. I get the impression they just do not be bothered with it. If they put this guy up long enough, get it. Man, the surveyor's seal is 1/8 of an inch high and 1/4 of an inch too far to the left on the final document. He didn't sign it exactly in that same place that he should have, and all kinds of crappy little
bills. And all those problems in this bill.
You know,
We had a bunch of land that's forgotten from the state up there, and we decided, our assembly decided to subdivide it and sell it all. Now, the state is subdividing for it. I don't know, they had no problem there.
Same way the Kenai Borough.
I assume that they hired a surveyor, just like we're talking about, and went out and surveyed the state. We had no problem getting that done.
The only problem we have is they, under the last administration, under this administration, that they have no land disposal policy. They simply have failed to make public land available. And that's why these kind of bills are here, because many legislators think that state land should become available.
And if this administration was interested in doing it, they'd go back and rewrite regulations for the home site program and get that going, if they were interested in letting land go. That's why I suspect that, you know, they're going to fool around with this for years and years.
When I put the open entry bill in, they just came from upstairs. It's like a swarm of locusts to pick that bill apart and show why it was
not. You can notice they're not here today.
Mr. Parr, that's what I'm betting on. Because I think this thing, I'm just judging from the, you know, from the response that I've had from people all over the state, you know, that this is something that a lot of people feel, you know, very strongly about this land situation, not being able to have some land. And I don't think, frankly, I don't think once you get the vehicle legislation on the books, I don't think the legislature will let them sit on it. That's what I'm betting on.
I think you're right.
Yeah, we now have.
Okay, the regulation.
Mr.
Chairman?
Yeah. Sam? Well, just, I think we're on one point here, and that's whether or not the state should actually pick out a chunk of land and then go through it and flat it. And there's going to be some desirable lots and some not so desirable. Some of them are going to be having a swamp on it. So they're going to, you know, they're going to really have a tough time saying that any given 100 acres, they're going to probably only have 50 that are really suitable. But maybe more, maybe. Maybe not. In any event, once they do that, how many people are going to want to participate in this program? Probably everybody will, whether it's LA. As long as it's okay to own property, I think you can find everybody interested in this.
Not everybody's going to want to build a house.
Okay, they got 65 million acres they can play with all this stuff.
That's a good point.
you know, any way you look at it.
You gotta go with it.
Do you wanna go build a house?
I'm looking at mine, 3 miles away from the Captain's Alley.
I just want to make, I made a statement before, and it's when we talked about the prohibition against people on the property. I don't think I've ever proposed or tried anything in my life, as far as I was concerned, that I was more unselfish on my part. I own property, and I've had one home site. My God, I don't ever want to have to go through another. No way.
It's cheaper to buy it.
It's cheaper to go buy it. Somebody else will build it, if you can afford it. But I appreciated, you know, the fact that when I did need it, it was there. And it was a great help.
Okay. Is there any kind of prohibition? I couldn't see any prohibition against subdividing.
May I respond, Mr. Chairman? I had hoped to do this by lot size, and this is one of those things I debated about, because I didn't want to be able to subdivide. I mean, I wanted to get it down small enough, you know, again, to keep the speculator out of it. I didn't want anybody to be able to do it, you know, to try to rip off. If the guy wanted a home, a place to build a house, that I wanted to have. No more. You know, and so, again, I thought we could do this by the lot size. And again, the 2 acres was strictly a, you know, I just reached out there and got, and I said, if it's 5 acres, you may be making a trailer park out of it. I don't want them to do that. If it's 1 acre, it might be too much of a problem for the division of lands, you know, when they're chopping, as I see the way they will do it, the division way they'll do it. They're not going to be able to just go out there and lay out a bunch of nice little squares and say, here's a lot, 2 and 3 and 4. There's going to be canyons and mountains and things around, you know. Of course, this is probably a reaction from the southeasterner, but there's no that much flat land, so they can have all these nice little blocks. So, you know, I thought with 2 acres, one lot might be an acre and a quarter, another one might be 3/4, another one might be.
He's not concerned about it. I know of many cases what the land the state has sold down there. There's a few recreation sites tonight, and people are going in on veterans' preference and everything else like that. I know they just, right from the beginning, they said, oh, hey, I veterans' preference, I get in here and get this land, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut it in 3 pieces and sell these 2 off and pay for my other one. Well, maybe that's fine, and that's nice that that happened to him. What about the other people that would have liked some land, too? And it seems like they're getting a good deal from the state at the expense of other people who would like to get a good deal also. And that, you know, if the state's going to give people a good deal, I don't mind doing that, but it shouldn't do it to the detriment of other people who would like a good deal too. And because the purpose isn't here to give land to people to subdivide and make money off other people. Because if you're going to try and make money off the people in the state, you gotta get it so everybody can share.
Well, that's right, the prohibition is.
Is there any kind of legal problems with doing that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems to be pretty clear that you could not subdivide while you have the permit for that 3-year period. You have to occupy the land. And the land is in a parcel not exceeding 2 acres. That's my more. It seems pretty clear to me that you could not subdivide while you occupy it. At such time as you receive the patent conveying an unencumbered title, as noted on page 22, then your local zoning and planning regulations are permitted in terms of the lot sizes you have to have subdivided related matters. Then I see nothing to prevent the subdivision after you get patent.
But we could mandate that that would not be allowed in here, and that would be constitutional.
I don't know if maybe there's some other ideas on that.
It's got to be, if local guys can keep you from it, and they're bound by the Constitution, state government can certainly mandate that in the statutory form and say that you can.
Well, they have to act reasonably at the local level. I mean, they do permit some subdivision, but it depends on the size of parcel you want to subdivide and matters like that. I'm thinking about an unreasonable restraint on alienation, and I don't know the answer offhand. There is a doctrine that you can't provide unreasonable restraints on alienation land. Offhand, I would say, yes, you could convey a title which had a condition in it that you could not subdivide that parcel. That would be my offhand reaction.
Mr. Chairman, I that's one of the things I thought about, and I backed off. I don't want, when this character earns this piece of land, and believe me, that's the way I look at it. Some people say you're giving him some land. I'm not the way I look at it. He's earning it every bit of it, and he goes there and builds a home on it. I don't want any stigma. I don't want any, it wasn't my idea that once we went through this and he got his patent, to me, I want that to be all his, as far as I'm concerned, it was his, and you know, if he signed in, he wanted to, after he's gone through all of this, and wanted to sell it, and somebody else buy it, or whatever. But I think it, in my view, it would be better if you're worrying about subdividing. And that wasn't my idea, that it should be reasonable to subdivide. But I'd rather you do that. I think it'd be better if you did that with a lot size, rather than, you know, making it a different type of land after the guy does get that.
I guess we're talking about a 4-year period, a year at least, to get something back to live. Maybe that's good in 3 years. I'm not sure how many people live speculative type for less than the 4 years to get a plot by myself.
I agree with something about it, but
it's probably not that big of a problem. I don't know if you could put a requirement on good subdivide it. But you figure that's a 4-year term at least we're talking about.
Yeah.
The guy's just buying it.
By the time the guy gets the patent, well, look at what happened in Anchorage. As you recall, those of you who were there 25 years ago, when all of the those 2.5-acre, 5-acre home sites were out, you know, pushing out towards Rabbit Creek and in that area. Then as the area got crowded, it really became more desirable to start to buy those, and they made, you know, what are the lots today, but this is sort of the normal process, and not unreasonable. There wouldn't have been any reasonable reason to say, after conditions changed, that those lots shouldn't have been subdivided, because, you know, it was a need for the building lots.
Now, wait a second, doesn't this guy get, I mean, he earns, in a manner of speaking, but doesn't he get this 2 acres by going in there and putting up a dwelling, paying $10 and having it surveyed? He doesn't, does he pay the state, $500 per acre? Well, I mean, where does the guy that comes in and gets this land pay the state for the land? Okay. I just want to check. I didn't work you paying anybody for the land, except in sweat, blood, sweat, and tears. I campaigned on being a homestead kid, you know, and I was a slave. Well, I mean, it seems like I don't see what's wrong.
Because at some later date he sells it off. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but he sells an acre and gets $10,000 for that acre, though he put in some blood, sweat, and tears on it. But the gardener,
he may want to sell the whole thing.
Why should he get the $10,000?
There's always going to be more Alaska land around. Bradley's are going to have another one. I mean, you know. They got just as much right to have their own state land as anybody else. And so somebody's kind of gaining an advantage at by using the good heart of the state. And I have no problem giving it to them in the first place, but I just don't think like that they ought to be utilizing that to make a buck off of somebody else. I mean, everybody ought to have the right to get the same land.
But he can do the same thing with the whole thing. You know, he can sell his home in 2.5 acres.
Well, let's say if he wants to
sell it, he might even make more by holding a big chunk.
I'm just wondering how you feel about putting a subdivision restriction for a certain number of years. You can't make a permanent. You can't go out there and place and expand, and all of a sudden you're going to need you really can't afford to have a collector lot. You can't afford to pay for a sewer connection to come out, I'm assuming, close to town, because the cost is so high. And this is one of the big problems, you have a subdivision type place. And so I think indefinite, permanent construction, you could say something like 5 years after we have it, now see, we can't subdivide, or something like that.
I think it could.
So Mr. Bickie does have a good point, things do change.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, make it, it's my contention that considering the size of our population and the amount of land that we have to available in the state, that it's a ridiculous situation when a person has to pay $10,000 an acre for land in Alaska. Now that's, you know, that's,
oh, yeah,
that's the whole approach. And if the guy that comes along, you know, and can come up with his 2 acres somewhere down the line, he's not going to have to pay $10,000. And I, you know, this is a, I wouldn't, you know, maybe this is my own idea about the proper way to cut out on land speculation. But, you know, that's a problem.
It's so little available.
Like a burning center.
Well, I have, let me give you an example. I have a house in Ketchikan that many years ago I bought and paid outright cash for it. I paid $8,500. Today, the lousy lot on it's assessed at $15,000. And here, you know, this is ridiculous in a state where we only have 400,000 people and millions upon millions of acres of land. That's criminal, outright criminal. And you know, you can
catch the answer to an attractive place.
No, sure, we're just boxed in. We have no place to get in.
That's right.
Just have to mark up that deal, deliver it to paper. Go paid off. Really sneak.
Okay, well, I'd like to have some kind of indication. Why don't we just start going through the bill and amending this up, some of the several suggestions. I guess the first one was there, Charlie, you had to take one more.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to amend 924 to read the director shall classify any survey for the same amendment, but strike the word in 9.6 and strike the word A and get a definite for Mr. Brown.
Charlie, I think I'm a little more than that. What? In other words, how to read it in context.
The director shall classify and survey for homes by entry, state land which is otherwise vacant, unincorporated, and unreserved, and suitable for erection of residential dwelling to use as a permanent building. Now, I'm making it plural, I indicate the word you as a big section.
Yeah. Should they understand him, man?
Yes.
Any objection, then?
Mr. Chairman, may I raise just a, sure, like, be a technical question? It could be read as meaning possibly that all vacant, inappropriate, unreserved land upon which a residence could be erected has to be so classified, which is clearly not the committee's intent. And so that leads you to clarify the question of saying something like, shall classify and survey a reasonable amount of the vacant, unappropriated, unreserved land, or a certain percentage of the vacant, unappropriated, unreserved land. It's a technical question that comes to my mind. If you read it literally.
My amendment would have read the director shall classify and survey by certainly state land suitable for homestead country, which is otherwise vacant, unappropriated, I'm afraid that it's not restrictive enough either. That we want to tell him to take some of the land, not all of it, obviously.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, most of your statutes which authorize the classifications under this title now talk in terms of may.
Yeah, I think that's my biggest problem.
I have no objection, Mr. Chairman, to use a reasonable amount of
reasonable proportion or I'm not sure if the department would object to that, but they'd object less than that the state of a certain percentage.
The department would learn something different. We might have
would read shall classify and serve for homestead interstate land For some homesite entity, a reasonable proportion of state land which is otherwise, something to that effect.
We could do it much more simply by using Charlie's amendment, just putting the word some state land.
That doesn't change.
Whoever's back here next year will have to come on and take a look at it, see what he's done.
Some state land.
It seems like to me that if you're gonna put in some kind of standard, it ought to be something that has some meaning, some land in front of it. Why don't you work on that sentence there and come up with something? I think that would be good to have something like that in there.
If the committee prefers, Mr. Chairman, I suppose we could leave it as stated in maybe a sentence of intent of the committee report, or this is intended to be a reasonable report. I think very few would read it literally. The sentence, they read it literally without saying some state.
Well, it'd be impossible.
Reading it, construing it with other statutes would be almost impossible to say all state land. On the other hand, this is the latest enactment, so you don't want somebody to argue they've repealed all the other classifications to get into this kind of, somebody wants to play, you know, legal game.
If you look on page 2, line 89, it says they're going to do this for a rate basis, okay? Their rate is the same process, not reasonable. And taking into account other statutory responsibilities, now, wouldn't other statutory responsibilities also include their responsibility to classify a certain land which is suitable for residential purposes, but where the highest and best use is general, or also that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carr, it covers their selecting lands for other classifications, and it covers their responsibilities in other areas of the statute, such as dealing with the mental health school lands and others.
It does not mean what you suggest.
Well, I sure think it implies that clearly what you mean is a reasonable amount of state land.
The problem I have with that particular paragraph is that it also implies that they should, you know, they could do this after they got done with taking care of the other problems that they might have. That's the problem I have with the follow up on.
Okay, where are we at? The only thing we have proposed so far is the classifying. I want to try and send the rest of the committee before these bills be put on there for any hour now, anyway.
All right. I think it's part of the letter. I would start over.
Is there any objection to Mr. Clark's amendment?
Mr. Chair, before we move on from that particular thing, would somebody take a look at my question about the 2 1/4 acre survey, whether that makes any difference? To a normal pattern.
It
has not been a surveyor that told this to me.
I'm curious about you. 340 acres is your standard land block. It divides very nicely by 2. It divides nicely by 2 1/4.
I don't understand.
I don't understand how that's below 2 1/4.
Well, I think it's a question of rectangular survey. I'm not sure. Are you going to move on past page 2?
It's a good way to sell one.
No.
How about the top page 2?
Oh, okay.
An amendment. There's an amendment there to, that was the place we're going to put in the cost of service.
If you want that.
Right.
I have an objection.
After paying the cost of service. That's your amendment
there? Where? The word year is not that I'm going to. You have to pay into cost of service.
And that's the parking cost of the cost.
Chairman, I would suggest after years on page 2, line 1, I understand 10, you would add and paying the cost of survey of the land, if you read the entire sentence, after occupying the land and half of the land for a period not less than 7 months each year for three consecutive years, and paying the cost of survey of the land. I think that would be good, because you mandate surveying the first sentence prior to that.
Does everybody understand the First Amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Amendment's adopted. Okay, I guess along with that amendment, we just wipe out section D of page 3.
But this is all this says to do is he agrees to do that. You know, he knows it's not going to pay for the let's say, agree to. Why don't we change the pay for the land?
Yeah, because it says he can't.
I would leave it on.
Leave that in. That
agree. We'll change the wording.
Mr. Chairman, I might suggest agree to pay for the length of survey required under this section. Or required under this subsection.
When would he have to come up with that money in one lump sum?
It is time. Before you get the patent.
I mean, that kind of lets
it out. But that would be surveys before he ever went on there. Right, so then he can be a fixed cost before he entered it to wreck his habitable dwelling and then occupy it for 3 years.
Right, he'd be issued the permit for the surveyed land, live on it for 3 years, and then when he qualifies for patent, assuming he has to reach any conditions, he'd get the patent on payment of the survey. That's the way I was there.
Yeah, I mean, he knows the survey costs $1,000 before he even goes and does it, because it has to be done in order to.
Yes, that's why it's good to keep in there at D on page 3. Agree to pay for a survey, so you know.
Well, and also now, the way this is working, let's say the guy builds a house and he's broke because he just got done fighting those machines. And he can't pay the house a survey. Well, all he has to do is wait until he has the money to apply for the title, so it allows him to wait when he doesn't have money.
Still,
he's not going to lose his office. Yeah, he's not going to lose the
okay, is there any objection to the revised wording in subsection B there on page 3? No objection.
Could we go back to page 2, whatever it is? I'm just raising the question, not necessarily suggesting that we do it. Under the condition, beginning on line 21, priority and award of an income permit shall be according to basic approved and limited resident, et cetera. I would like to suggest that you might like to consider just simply making that home site available on a drawing basis rather than this rather ponderous situation and, you know, prioritize it. I'm just thinking that we may have problems with this.
It seems like you'd have more problems there. It's kind of a burden of proof thing. The guy comes in and says, I want to apply, so he's kind of got to prove it. I guess the only problem is not people.
Well, and, you know, this always opens up a certain amount of room for whereas, you know, if you did it by, you could just eliminate a lot of the requirements of checking, et cetera, if you did it just on a drawing basis. I don't think that's enough.
Most of the very hot weather is on the ground, so some of them have petitions signed by they were very hot about it. The fact that people brand new who had just come would go out and get out there. And the other thing, of course, they have said was the fact that you weren't eligible if you were at home. They said, after all, people have been here, they've worked hard, and you're going to your Boston property to have a house. Somebody who just arrived here last week from Lower 48, they haven't got any property here, they haven't been here, they're going to get away. I do think we're keeping the priority on it. At least it's another problem, you know, same old thing. Right. But I do think that some kind of a long-term tenure thing in state should be a few of us here.
I don't know, check of that, but what I'm talking about specifically are the portions proof of length of residence might be okay with applicant who at the time of application holds no title to or interest other than as a tenant for a limited term in a dwelling suitable for permanent place to abode, including without limited to a mobile home, irrespective of whether or not it's attached to land connected utilities. I just think that's kind of a difficult condition, and I would suggest that...
Well, isn't it what it's saying, though, is that you and I can spend and live here for 25 years. We go in, I don't have a home, you do, I get to go ahead and... That's what that says to me.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I don't know what Chairman Halley works. I suppose you got one guy who's 25, another guy who's 10. But does that mean that nobody who owns a property is eligible at all?
And is this language can meet property not living in the
house? See, it implies talk about the priority of the clause.
Yeah.
And the priority is to an applicant who doesn't own the property. How do you mesh the priority of owning the property under the priorities of a certain length of residence or less? That's why I'm confused and glad you have a lot of fun with that.
I think it's a real problem in that mobile home language. I think you can solve the whole thing by just simply putting it on a drawing basis.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is not an easy one. It's probably going to want, you know, that cause more discussion than anything else, but it was never, I never envisioned this thing that I said before. I never envisioned that there's something to entice or draw people to Alaska. I came to Alaska like a lot of other people, but then I took my turn and lived by the rules as it were at the time. But if you don't give some preference to the people who have lived here, and that's exactly what you're going to do. And that's what's going to happen when you start drawing them out of a hat. You know, the guy that just flew in from Oshkosh yesterday.
No, excuse me. I think you made a mistake here.
All right.
I'm not talking about, I would in no way want to suggest that you reduce the residence requirement.
All right.
But I am talking about having a hell of a problem when you say that you can't own, have a title or an interest in a dwelling, so it's a perfect place to abode. It could be outside or in a mobile home. So that's the portion of what I think you've got a problem with.
Keith, or what you're saying is you prioritize the basis of residency.
Right, exactly. If you have to, draw them out of a hat, but don't prioritize on the basis of whether or not the guy owns. You know, he might have, for example, I happen to own some land in Kentucky, we'll say, and I'm not interested in this. Believe me, I've been through this homestead business. I don't want to forget. But if I were new up here, well, my son, for example, owns an interest in some land just outside, too. We'll say, I just happen to think of it. He would be excluded from this program because it doesn't say where that interest in land might be. You see what I mean? And I think that's a real problem. Or maybe that, maybe I own a mobile home, you see. And I'd be excluded. And I don't think that's right.
Mr. Chairman, he's not excluded. This is what we fought about.
No, but you're, by prioritization, you're excluding.
Yeah, well,
you know, let's face facts.
Okay.
You're going to put the guy down at the bottom of a list, so he obviously can't ever be drawn through this criteria. I'm not talking about the residency criteria. I believe in that, and I think it's vital to the bill. But I think that when you say if the guy owns a mobile home, I just don't think you're ever going to be able to make that stick. I want the bill, and I'm trying to find these things that are going to kill them.
Mr. Chairman, that's the only thing, again, going back, was that, as Keith well knows, the natural resources that we decided, you know, that it wasn't logical to try to fly it with the prohibition as far as ownership was concerned. So put this in the preferences, put this guy on the bottom. As far as I'm concerned, you know, I wish I always make coming up with horrible examples, but... you know, if, as far as I'm concerned, if one guy owns a $100,000 home and has lived here 40 years, another guy has no home at all and has only lived here 10 years. Now, in my mind, there's no question about who should have the land. You're talking about prayer. So, you know what, I'm not saying that's what everybody else would think, but I want the guy that doesn't have a home, I want him to go to the top of the list. And, you know, to me, that's a whole guts of thing. And if you get away from that, if you don't do that, then you're back into speculation. You're having people who own a $1,000 home and doesn't really want this place out here for a home, but wants it for a summer cabin. And here's some poor peon down here that, you know, is just barely making enough money to pay his rent, and he can't afford a summer cabin. You know, that's the whole problem, Mr. Chairman.
The advantage under this way that's given is the progeny, you know. Your son's a real exception, David, because he's got some that interest in some land outside. But the advantage he's going to have here is your sons and daughters of guys who've been up here 30 years and that were born up here and that are 19, 20 years of age and don't know a lot.
And they're entitled to bring
they for that. They have some move. Get up.
I'd like to take the age restriction out too, at least lower it. And besides that, the citation we've got here is wrong. You know, I think it's supposed to be 25, 45.
I'll check that.
I checked and couldn't find any reference.
I haven't checked for that. This committee substitute had to be prepared again overnight.
And what's the reasoning?
Well, people get married and want to start families when they're 16, 17, or sometimes they don't necessarily have to be 19. How's that? Well, okay, 18.
Age majority is what is
19 is what they got. You don't have to be, how old do you have to be married? How old?
18. It used to be 18 for a male, 16 for a female, but they raised a female at 16.
Equalized. So now it's 18. Okay, at least make it 18.
I don't have an objection to 18, Mr. Chairman. I don't got to work.
I don't mind standardizing my age and my art.
Let's change that citation to 18 then.
Is that a legal problem?
The age majority?
No.
I agree with you on that, but I can see where there might be a reason. I'll make a motion to change page 2, line 29 to at the time of the application, having attained the age of 18, and delete the rest of the stuff that refers to the age of 18.
I have a question.
We're going to have legal problems if someone, say, at 18 entering a contract to stay.
That's not my contract. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Well, I guess the age that they're tracking now is 19, the age of majority. I would think this would amend the law to permit you to contract for this purpose at the age of 18. At the time of qualify for on-site entry, and if you qualify for entry, you're entitled to a patent. Have to be 18. Well, you'll certainly be old enough to get the deed.
Right.
Now, to end the first one is a contract too. The permit is a contract too. This would be an implied. This would be an exception, I think, by its very nature. If you say you can qualify at 18, you're amending the laws to capacity of the contract.
Well, you then under that same reasoning, why not wait the 17?
I just don't do it.
Well, so he's 17. Why not make a 16 when you legally do it? Where's
oh, come on.
19 was put in because primarily
for reason. Well, I think on this stage, especially, you'll see a lot of people of that young an age that would be certainly capable of going out and building a home.
I don't think that was a consideration.
You can conform to the contractual restrictions.
Well, conform by writing a law, that's good. And of course, if I should learn 17, 16 or 15.
Well, 18, you know, you're done with school, you can vote.
Are you still?
You can't drink. You can only drink at 19. But who's killed anyway?
All right. All those in favor of the amendment is right hand raising.
Going back on page 2, section along about 24, 25. How about people who are who have a lease, long-term lease, to build a house? Are they covered and not covered by this definition in here? No title or interest other than the tenant for the term. For example, in the Fairbanks area, and the university has a bunch of land which is leased for 55 years. People would like to go into a house. I wasn't sure whether they're included or they're in this group.
All right. Well, Mr. Chairman, the term "limited term" is, you know, is something that the committee may want to refine and may not want to refine more. Limited term would be a reasonable construction of limited term. Anybody who has a 55-year lease would be a tenant for more than a limited term.
They would. So they would be eligible.
They would be leased in priority. In other words, they would have an interest in a dwelling suitable as a permanent place of abode.
So the limited term is not included in 5-year lease, you don't include something like that.
5-year lease, month-to-month lease, 1-year lease.
Maybe. What about the Forest Service who every year have a priority right to renew their yearly home site lease? It's a year-to-year lease.
With the option to renew. I'd say they don't have a tenancy for a limited term,
In practice, they don't. But you know how it is legal.
Right.
That's the answer.
On the same lines with a fishing vessel qualified for a permanent place of abode.
If it's suitable as a permanent place of abode. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Elias, probably if that problem comes up, the commissioner would have to handle it by regulation. The law would say a dwelling suitable as a permanent place of abode, and that's a term we use a lot in the statutes. But if it's used mainly to live on all year rather than fish from, I would think you could argue it's a dwelling which is a permanent place of abode. If it's not used or lived on all year, but is suitable to live on all year,
that's a technical question in there. Well, if you're married, then is your wife necessarily then qualify under here? Or is she automatically own half of what you do? Is she automatically have an interest in your property? Could the wife claim that she doesn't own any interest and go out and have it her?
Wait, you mean when you get the patent to the land?
Well, you can buy land in your own name.
Did you ever get your wife's name?
Yeah. What I'm saying is, so if the husband owns, you know, the family owns a $100,000 home, and the wife would say that she doesn't own it,
That's exactly right. You can own it either way. You can own it privately, or you can own it for something.
You could just turn it over to one party.
Yes, you could, but you might be able to because you've got a mortgage on it.
The whole thing is, you can get around that is, how many people that own a $100,000 home are going to go out and live in a small house on a 2-acre parcel out in the woods someplace, 7 months out of the year? What are they going to do with the house? You know, I just wonder.
Mr. Chairman, I think we were considering this idea of the applicant or his household being drawn in under that phrase, applicant, but as the original bill turned out, only used that purpose for household in another aspect, the idea that nobody in your household can make application for a parcel. Only one person in the household can apply for a parcel. It doesn't go to the question of holding title on a piece of property, but I think that was considered.
You have enough problems with this household on conflict of interest bill.
Yeah.
You include household
To go to Mr. Elias's question, I don't know what the law says, the case law says, as to fishing boats as dwellings. But I would find it hard to characterize a fishing boat as a dwelling suitable as a permanent place of abode.
Well, for one thing, lots of Alaskans live on boats, so they go on mobile homes.
that just doesn't say.
You know, I would find it difficult to put a
ball in the
hole.
Not a fishing boat.
Not necessarily a fishing boat, but a ball. You know, they're going up down the harbor.
Sorry, I asked.
Okay, I wish after the meeting, I was rather than I have to go to the conference committee, but we'll continue to work on this.
I'll keep it, take over.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Do we have some testimony on this one?
No, we don't want it.
Dwayne Carlson.
We don't want his testimony.
I'd like to hear him say it once more.
He's over at Butsy.
Oh, he's in town.
Today?
Yeah, he's in Burnoff at Burnoff.
Oh, good. Equally to everybody. You have to belong to a church. You have to give a proper proof of a religious conviction. Having a bona fide religious conviction based on, you know, why do we give them some special right that I'm not entitled to because I don't belong to one of these bona fide churches?
It's a right they're guaranteed by the Constitution.
Well,
religious freedom.
Yeah, he also has a right to believe in something that is not the tenets of any organized church.
Just like that's conscientious objective. You, conscientious objective is just to discriminate. You had to belong to a church. And but now that's been changed by Supreme Court decisions. You don't have to belong to a church. You have to demonstrate bona fide belief or whatever.
Okay, let's just delete all reference to the church then. Anybody can get out if they want.
Well, that's how the bill should read. Be legal in my mind.
The bill reads that, and I can't vote for it politically. However, I think you're right constitutionally. So there we are.
Okay, that's two. Charlie, if you agree with me constitutionally, you had some time to think about it. I mean, you're my other constitutional expert. Okay, let the record note that this is an unconstitutional bill the Judiciary Committee is passing up.
It's passing up?
Yes. So we have a motion.
I move it passes out with individual recommendations.
Then the objection is
move to amend and do not pass recommendation.
Well, the recommendation is going to be whatever you want. The question, if you want to, there's a motion to move the bill out of committee. We'll vote on that. There are no Sam's. Oh, Sam, we got up the 7-157 and the 7th Advent. The last one, was that your motion?
My motion is to move. Committee sets up the Senate Bill 157, Labor Management, Public Employment, Race, and Out of Committee.
Is there any discussion on that motion?
No, I'm not supposed to. If I could, I suppose if Mr. Farr wanted to expound. Expand upon his motion to vote, or his objection to vote. So,
well, I wouldn't ask you to do that. I think we came in and hear what you're saying. Personally, having a strong view of religious convictions is based on Sam's teaching that the church is divided by the Constitution.
And Mr. Chairman, I agree with that. And also, were we to omit that and to make it a general reference to an individual belief, it would really turn into a right to work law. I'd like to have a look for that. See, I'm between the devil and deep blue sea on it. It's unconstitutional one way, which may well be the compromise that was worked out with whoever, AFL-CIO or anybody. And the other way, you know, it just really destroyed collective bargaining. So I can't go for either way.
Mr. Chairman, now, I don't think
constitutionality of any action we take is not going to be decided by us, it's going to be decided by people who are probably more informed than we are. So I don't think that's a legitimate reason to hold a bill up to me.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't want to rob this department to comply with, you know, many times, you know, you call upon to make decisions, but if in your mind something's unconstitutional, well, then you'd be going against your oath that you've sworn to uphold the Constitution, you know, to the best of your ability. So I think, you know, just in defense of anybody that has that sort of argument, although I don't happen to feel that it's unconstitutional personally, I think that anyone that does is obligated to maintain that objective unless they ask.
You're probably correct. If you have the background, you know, to really analyze this in that manner. I don't have a legal background.
Why don't you?
But I think it's proper that, I mean, I think it's something that if there is a conscience problem, it'll, and if this is going to be decided some at a different time, somewhere else, it's going to be a court that's going to decide. It's going to be a legislative body.
Correct.
My position on this is fairly simple. I intend to vote to move the bill out of committee. I intend to vote, sign it, do not pass. I intend to vote against it on the floor.
Which one's this?
7th and
that's the most vicious thing I've heard you say since I've been in this committee. My goodness, I'm shocked. You're going to vote to move it out?
Yes, sir.
That's the motion.
The minority witness made that motion just before you voted.
I apologize for not being here. I was sitting in my office waiting for the Democratic caucus to get over with.
Okay. Mr. Brown.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, just on the do we want to debate this principle for another 30 seconds? Everybody has to make a judgment. Everybody who has a constitutional position, and mine is just as constitutional as the Supreme Court or the governor, has to make a judgment on what is or is not constitutional every day to cover what he does or does not do or does or does not think is his responsibility. And I have never felt that no matter how I may be in favor of something, no matter what principle, but for the Constitution, that I can vote for an issue if I believe it to be unconstitutional. I don't think you have to be a constitutional lawyer to have that insight or that wisdom and that judgment either. Whether your training comes from being on a legislative committee for 6 years, or just the fact that you thought you read the Constitution and you understand the language of what it says. I can't vote to move the bill out of committee. I can't vote for the bill on the floor of the House the way it's written. And if my constitutional objections were removed from the bill, then I'd be against it as a matter of policy.
Mr. Speck, you haven't said it.
I'm interested in my colleague's view on where does the conflict come from.
Mr. Speck, the reason that several of us feel it's unconstitutional, at least one reason is that it only applies to certain people who have belonged to certain churches. It doesn't apply to anybody that has the same identical beliefs or any other ones that are even similar that doesn't belong to those churches which qualify. You have to have these bona fide religious convictions. It's just too narrow. It should apply equally to everybody, not just members of certain churches. It should apply to people who are Buddhists, atheists,
agnostics. If I could interrupt right there, it does say teachings of the church or religious body. It doesn't say Seventh-day Adventist.
Mr. Chairman, what's a religious body?
Mr. Chairman, may I expand on that?
Well, who does have to discuss that?
I just can't understand Mr. Brown.
Well, Chairman, you did.
Yes.
The problem with the bill constitutionally is that you only get the right if your belief is such that you do belong to an organized religious group. That then says that there is then discrimination against someone who may have very deep felt religious or ethical beliefs, but they do not coincide with the views of a particular organized religious group. It's discrimination. I believe the Supreme Court has said that that sort of thing is discrimination in interpreting laws regarding conscientious objectors, for instance. And I think it's unconstitutional for that reason. If you were to amend the bill to make it constitutional, so that it would apply to anyone, you know, with a bona fide belief along the guidelines of the Supreme Court cases, as far as I'm concerned, it would be a right to work law and economic law.
Mr. Chairman,
on policy is.
Just say eliminate the blame for this.
I understand your view, because I don't agree with them. I think personally, you can, you'd have to look hard to adopt that view.
I know a friend of mine that works for the state. He doesn't believe that in APEA or in unions in general, but especially in APEA, and doesn't feel that she ought to join the union work for the state. So what she does is, the way you get around is that you don't have a permanent job with the state. You work on a contract. Well, you know, but now we're going to tell somebody that belongs to, in this case, the people pushing this, is send the admins control that somehow we're going to work up some deal to take care of their problem. But what about the other people?
Do we have a motion on this?
The motion is to pass the bill.
Oh, well, I'll vote for it.
Is there any further discussion on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would say that I understand the separation of church and state constitution. The state is not supposed to do anything in favor of a particular religious group or belief, and it's not supposed to do anything to interfere with the sort of thing. I'm afraid it's just gives me the one category.
All those in favor of moving the bill out of the line, raise your right hand. All those opposed? Motion passes. We can see if this bill does any better recommendations than if you found any. Okay, go to Senate Bill 484. This is one we started scratching around on, the piece of garbage that was properly marked up in the Senate.
They just looked at the sponsor.
Yeah.
Passed it out. You have that, we don't have that.
I don't have it in my folder.
We had it practically rewritten, didn't we?
Senate Bill 484. And I'm trying to remember, I got a lot of things written down here. Did we adopt some of the amendments?
On page 1.
On line 12, we put public property or private property. Is that correct? And then we had a proposed amendment pertaining to subsections C and D, where you have to first find the person who abandoned the vehicle, and then if you didn't, then you were supposed to look for the person who was the lawful owner of the vehicle.
My note says, this beginning with D on 19, the word says effect. When the person referred to in C above cannot be identified as them, the lawful owner. But we wound up being hung up on that because of the problem of stolen vehicle and
did we adopt that? That's what you just read, Charlie?
No, I didn't read it.
Yeah, maybe, I think we might have used the same paragraph. And then on line 20, I have who has not cut out, put in whether or not.
Yeah, that's right, because we get a catch 22 instead of 0.
And then on line 22, some language we back to Charlie mentioned it. Just did not apply where the vehicle was stolen, either stolen or over to the general.
Yeah, well, if that's all in your notes, we can go ahead and move that as an item and get Victor drafted or somebody else. Well, we'd already gone through that.
Yeah, okay, I was just trying to recap.
This, we didn't have anybody down here who lives there.
No. Charlie, did you say that we had not totally adopted that because there was one other problem?
I don't remember. I think Brett Wright or somebody was going to be there.
Okay, yeah, we'll assume those are not enough. Eric will work on that. On line 29, we also had on state property across the...
Chairman, before you do that, I want to make sure I understand exactly where you're going. In D, the redraft will have that operative language conditional upon if the person is driving C can't be identified. And apparently you're going to change who has not complied to whether or not compliance has been made. I think we felt that had to be there so someone would not imply otherwise.
We were going to put the language whether or not he has complied.
Yeah, right. And then also there's going to be some additional language in D saying it does not apply to somebody who has, you know, whose vehicle has been stolen or something to do with it. And Mr. Chairman, I had a problem just one line. Oh, yes. Charlie, I believe we had asked Rick regarding what you were just saying to put in, to redraft language of section 2011.02 beginning of line 24, to put in the same, the good grammar and everything, the same kind of distinction that Charlie had us put in on subsection B in line 12, because it doesn't make any sense to have an owner of public property. That's just a, that's really a technical amendment.
Where's this?
Because it, public or private and so forth, the owner or person in charge of the property, you know, that's just not good construction when you're pumping public or private property together, and we wanted to make it with a little bit clearer language in the manner in which we had already amended subsection B above.
I guess I
didn't
understand exactly what you were saying.
What line are you on?
Starting on 25, for instance, or a vehicle left standing or parked on public or private property in excess of 24 hours of the owner, or a person in charge of the property.
Well, if you put in charge of the private.
For instance, up at line 12, it may have been a degree of a person in charge of the property, or upon private property without the consent of a person in lawful possession. Much more consistent with concepts of public and private land ownership. And we had asked, I think we even passed a motion, that there should be a parallel amendment to the language further on down the page with respect to that same distinction. I think we already passed that motion. And so I think we left it up to Rick as to how he would work it out and how there's a grammar. Mr. Chairman, around that same time, I had raised a problem that would be solved by the following message. I'll read 8-1, line really looks like 27. After the words "is presumed to be abandoned," change the period to a comma. And in certain language, I'll read it fast, and so or later on. Unless it is reclaimed and removed before action regarding removal under 2811.030 is taken.
That
makes sure that you don't have a cop standing there and he knows that you've been there for 25 hours and he just has to get you because he didn't like what you said to his wife the day before. So he goes in and says, "The law says I gotta take it away, Buster. I've been here for 24 hours. I don't care if you got the ignition key in your hand, you're about to climb in and drive it away. I've got it." Here it says it can be reclaimed by the owner until removal under section 2811 of the Code. Now
I'll read the language again. I move to amend page 1, line 27, change the period after the word abandoned to a comma, and insert the words unless it is reclaimed, and remove before action regarding removal under 28.1103.30 is commenced or begun.
So I'll just say action to remove is undertaken.
Is undertaken, I suppose. Yeah.
You want to run through the whole thing?
Yeah, is undertaken. Okay, once more. Change the period after man to a comma and insert the words unless it is reclaimed and removed before action regarding removal under 28.1103.30 is undertaken. Perhaps we should say is reclaimed or removed by the owner or person in charge of the vehicle. I'm not sure.
We'll go ahead and move the amendment, I guess.
I presume we're moving the concept with the requirements.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, I got to ask.
Yeah. You might just say instead of where he refers to 28.1103.0, the same section 30 of this chapter.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. That's a revisor of statutes. So maybe that's better form. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Thank you.
On the same section, it was brought up the other day when we were working on the bill that perhaps we ought to make a provision for the fact that these regulations aren't going to be in effect, and in the meantime, the 48-hour and the 24-hour provisions would stand without the regulations. So as Dennis pointed out, that there's going to be some cases when they're going to allow that sort of thing to happen. And in the meantime, until the regulations go into effect, there might be a problem.
What would it apply to this?
Well, in some cases, the department may, in their regulations, allow vehicles to stand on the highway for more than 48 hours.
What we were talking about was suspending the effect of this section until the regulations went into effect.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
That was the idea we were talking about, was to say that this section of the law wouldn't become effective until the adoption of regulations.
Okay, so maybe then should that be included as part of the section?
Attempt to make it through this, I'd like to.
That's all you're going to take out today?
Yeah. Well, that's so Charlie's got to leave. I don't know where.
I got to go for about 10 or 15 minutes.
What time do you have?
How's that?
What time are you
having? Right now.
Oh.
Or at 3, if I could just get going. And go. I don't want to disrupt it. It looks like you guys can probably handle my business.
Yeah. I'll
be back.
Be sure to come back. Okay.
My next problem is page 2, line 20.
Anybody got anything else on page 1? 3, right? Brown?
My next problem is page 2, line 27. Maybe somebody got something before that. R, somewhere. Blank.
No, see, isn't it? 27?
Yeah, if you got anything before that, you have a problem. The method of notice be set forth
and to have the same method of notice as provided for summary foreclosure of a real property, or rather deed of trust. It's language that you can borrow straight out of Title 34. That is, it says regular once every week for 3 weeks in the newspaper, general something or other. And it's all standard language and it's used quite frequently. I think it's also used in the probate code and other places.
Don't they use standard and other publication procedures anywhere?
Well, yeah, but we don't say so in this bill. Therefore, we don't really know that they will. And if you really want to leave it up to regulation, that's fine, but I prefer to put it in the bill.
I don't object to that.
I believe it's once every week for 3 successive weeks in the newspaper, general jurisdiction, with a bunch of explanatory language, and it's nearly the same in Title 34 under summary foreclosures of deeds of trust and in the probate code on publication of notice to creditors. That may be a higher rate than we need, but 3 successive times anyway. And Mr. Chairman, I would like to move to change if there's no objection to that. Is there any other rules on that? I don't know that.
Publication.
Oh, you mean the service of process by publication? Right. I never even thought of that. Yeah, that's a lesson. Rule 4.
Okay. Strike period on the line 27 and 28.
The intent would be to have the same procedure for notice that you would use a notice to absent a defendant serving a lawsuit by publication provided for in Rule 4 of the Alaska Civil Rules of Alaska Rules of Civil Procedures. The same notice requirements, which I think is once every week or 3 successive weeks. That way you wouldn't have to put it all in the bill and just incorporate it by reference. Right?
Okay, you can answer this.
Mr. Brown, is that you?
That's what I'm making.
Okay, does everybody understand the new motion? Okay, for the rules of civil procedure. Okay, no objection to the amendments adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know about page 3, line 2, change 10 to 33.
Where is that?
Page 3, line 2.
Is there a date on that? Excuse me, I thought it said 60.
Well, that's what this one is for, and that other.
Oh, well, that applies to a different situation, Mr. Chairman.
That was the difference on the. Yeah, that's on the storage charge proceeding resolution.
30 is all right then, right, sir?
I think 30 is better, yeah.
Your move was to change to 30?
Yeah.
Is there any objection to changing 10 to 30 and then page 3 line 2? Hearing no objection, amendments adopted.
Mr. Chairman. Page 3, at the end of line 10, I would move to insert a sentence to be drafted by staff to accomplish the following result. That redemption of the vehicle may be made by the person who presents satisfactory proof of ownership or right to possession and so forth. That redemption may be had up to the time the title is actually transferred to up to the time of the holding of the public auction set forth in the next section. That is, the guy can walk up to a public auction and just say, hey, that's mine, before they start, and the section would require him to pay the costs that have been incurred so far.
All costs.
Yeah.
It just doesn't specify now.
See, right now it just says that it doesn't say that the redemption period goes that far. It does say that he pays the actual costs and so forth. And in the event that he redeemed it just before the auction, of course, then he's going to have to pay for the publication of the auction, that sort of thing, or his car back. So he might not bother if it's a $300 junker,
it's a Chevy truck, you know, what's going to happen if it's a Rolls Royce Silver Plow? No, I've seen the
things. Why they're not, yeah. What's that?
Does that make sense to you? Makes sense to me.
I haven't seen one, I don't know why.
When I have the research, I don't know that you wouldn't have to change the three.
Hey, man. Come in.
Redemption, under like, the land, whether or not the practice is best, so.
So.
See what I'm saying? Ordinary redemption, I don't know how to best. You have a vesting here, they're dead.
Well, you're going to say the title is vested back, you have a problem with vesting title. I use the phrase, may redeem vehicle and regain title after that period. And use the phrase and regain title upon proof of ownership and payment of all costs, reasonable costs that have actually been incurred and so forth. And that takes care of your title problem by inserting the words and regain title.
What sort of problems now? We've already invested the title somewhere else.
Yeah, right. So
okay, now we've got
that. That's what Rick pointed out to me. So the language can simply say for this later redemption, you have to put in words and regain title.
Would we be better off to roll off the title vesting than to last back?
No, not operationally, because in 99% of your cases, or at least a majority of your cases, nobody's going to show up and they'll just clinker up the works.
Thanks, guys.
What did he do?
He signed it wrong.
Hey, let's see. Hold up. Who's
got it?
I can't believe that this is going to be Jordy Dewar.
Hey, you know, what was the country founded on? This is real.
And this is political screws.
You know,
the
constitutionality test, as I recall last year, Fed voted for a bill that was unconstitutional. Because the Supreme Court said it was.
Well,
you confirm people on these commissioners.
Well,
you thought it was, you said it was, but it wasn't, so you were wrong.
Okay, Brent, state your
I believe myself.